From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump is praising his son for disclosing emails that show how the Trump campaign met with a Russian lawyer in an active search for incriminating information about Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton last year. The principal deputy White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, read a brief statement by the president to reporters Tuesday saying that my son is a high-quality person and I applaud his transparency. The president's statement did not discuss ramifications of the emails his son released. The U.S. and Qatar have signed a memorandum of understanding to fight terrorism. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson arrived in Doha Tuesday after meetings in Kuwait. Tillerson's visit to Qatar is aimed at helping resolve the dispute between the Persian Gulf nation and its neighbors. After Tillerson's meeting with his Qatari counterpart, they announced the agreement on terrorism. The two met with reporters to discuss the memorandum, which Tillerson says was reached after lengthy meetings. The commander of coalition forces in Iraq says he hopes Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is deader than a doornail, but he cautioned regardless of whether the terror leader is alive or dead, the fight to reclaim all of Iraq from the group's grip is far from over. There's been a steady stream of reports regarding Baghdadi's death in recent weeks, including claims by the Russians that Syrians and the Iranians. Earlier Tuesday, the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said it had information confirming the death of the IS leader. An Iranian cancer researcher traveling to the U.S. on a valid visa has been detained in Boston, along with his wife and three children. This is VOA News. The FBI says a U.S. Army sergeant arrested for allegedly trying to help Islamic State has a long history of making threats and pro-extremist statements. The Ikaika Kang has made his first court appearance in Honolulu and was ordered to remain behind bars. FBI Special Agent in Charge Paul Delacour.
Kang was arrested by FBI SWAT based on probable cause that he had committed material support to terrorism because he had sworn to bayat and because he had shown an increased inclination to violence.
According to an FBI affidavit filed in federal court, the Army reprimanded Kang as early as 2011 for threatening to kill fellow soldiers and praising Islamic militants. He lost his military security clearance in 2012, but later had it reinstated, and he has remained on active duty throughout. The FBI says the Army feared Kang was becoming radicalized and turned his case over to federal investigators in 2016, and since then, Kang allegedly said the gunman who killed 49 people at a gay nightclub in Orlando did what he had to do. Kang has also been heard lauding Hitler and calling for the mass murder of Jews. Aid agencies say that they welcome the Trump administration's promise of nearly $640 million to help four countries dealing with rampant food insecurity, but say the pledge is overdue and taking too long to reach the people who desperately need it. President Donald Trump announced the pledge at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany last weekend, several weeks after Congress approved the expenditures for Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen. The International Olympic Committee Tuesday has decided to award the 2024 and 2028 Summer Olympic Games in the same session, in a move that would effectively guarantee that Paris and Los Angeles will be the winners. The two cities have been lobbying heavily to host the international sporting event. The French capital last hosted the Games in 1924. Los Angeles did so back in 1984. In a tweet Tuesday, U.S. President Donald Trump says working hard to get the Olympics for the United States. Stay tuned. The winning bids will be announced on September 13th in Peru. The Olympic movement has had trouble attracting prospective hosts because of the amount of money involved. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is warning to retaliate if the U.S. does not return two Russian diplomatic compounds seized last year. Lavrov did not say what specific steps the Kremlin would take. Former President Barack Obama expelled 35 Russian diplomats and shuttered two Russian-owned compounds in Maryland and California in the closing weeks in his administration in December. It was a reaction to the allegations that Russia meddled in the presidential election. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Trump administration delays a decision to lift sanctions on Sudan.
This is good news to me because this will give us a chance to look for more information and look at some of the less obvious issues that we were wondering about, meaning some of the counterterrorism cooperation.
Omar Ismail is the senior policy advisor for the Enough Project. Uganda's main opposition leader calls for the dissolution of President Museveni's government if the country is to have lasting peace. The World Bank gave $56 million to stabilize Gambia's fragile economy. And jailed Zambian opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema says he's willing to hold unconditional talks with the government.
Everything must be discussed, including the elections for last year, even to do with the arrest of Hakainde Hichilema and other political prisoners. It has to be discussed. We think that is the only way you can diffuse the tension.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. Meanwhile, the Zambian government says President Lungu has always been open to dialogue on national issues, and a family planning summit in London is overshadowed by U.S. funding cut. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Trump administration has extended the period to review sanctions on Sudan. In January this year, before leaving office, President Barack Obama signed an executive order to lift sanctions on Sudan by the 12th of July this year if Sudan met certain criteria. In an executive order issued Tuesday, President Donald Trump extended the lifting of the sanctions, saying the United States will revoke the sanctions if the Sudan government is assessed to have sustained progress. Omar Ismail, senior policy advisor to the Washington-based rights group Enough Project, says Sudan has made some progress in the five-track engagement process laid down by former President Barack Obama, but he says it has failed in others, including fighting between the government and rebel groups in North Darfur.
This is good news to me because this will give us a chance to look for more information and look at the some of the less obvious issues that we were wondering about, meaning some of the counterterrorism cooperation. And it is interesting that in the comments of the State Department, at the bottom of it, the State Department statement, they talked about Sudan should adhere to all the UN resolutions with regard to North Korea. That is something that wasn't there for everybody to know. However, from now on, in the next coming 3 months, people will start looking at that and see if the two pariah nations have some sort of cooperation, to what extent, at what level, and what is the outcome of that. So this is the kind of chance that this 3 months will give us to have more information.
Previously, you personally called for at least 6 to 1 more year for the administration to really look at Sudan and its progress on the five-track program. Is 3 months a long enough time?
It is not a long enough time since we asked for 6 months to a year. However, it is something. We can't just strike it out and say, this is nothing. It will give us a chance to look at the dark corners, and also will give us a chance to bring in more people into the debate. And like we agreed earlier, that the jury is still out on the validity of sanctions and whether they are important in terms of changing behavior of countries.
And this is a decision that could potentially impact millions of Sudanese. Could you talk a bit more about how important this decision is?
It is very important, and I'm sure that now it is maybe the small hours of the morning in Khartoum, and people are waking up to this decision. So many people will be disappointed in the government. I'm sure many others in the streets will be happy that at least the sanctions are not lifted today, because many Sudanese view this as a reward, an undeserved reward to the Khartoum regime, which is still curbing freedoms and will not give people a chance to assemble, and still destroying churches in an obvious intolerance for the differences between its citizens. You know, it remains to be seen now that the annual reporting is stricken out at Section 11 in the new executive order. It remains to be seen what does that mean in terms of the decision itself. Is it going to be already a predetermined thing that is they're going to lift the sanctions 3 months? We don't know. Because I think if we are keeping the sanctions, then the annual reporting is important.
Last month, in June, you argued for a new policy framework between the United States and Sudan. What did you mean by that? And how does this decision impact your argument?
We're still calling on new policy that is based on, you know, the leverage of the United States to be exercised to push Sudan to change in terms of, you know, its behavior towards its own citizens, and to change in terms of its strategy and combating the violence in the different areas of Sudan, because we believe that it's still the government of Sudan was stuck to the strategy of military solution to the problems in the contentious areas. We think that the U.S. should exercise more pressure on Sudan to look at the financial dealings of the ruling elite, what we call the violent kleptocracy in the country, and using the financial tools that we have, from fencing to all the other measures of anti-money laundering, to look into the dealings of Khartoum and the transfer of illicit funds between Khartoum and other countries and other bodies.
Omar Ishmael is the Enough Project Senior Policy Advisor. He was speaking with IMBO from Washington. Jail Zambian opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema says he's willing to hold unconditional talks with the government of President Edgar Lungu. Mr. Hichilema's United Party for National Development, UPND, had said it does not recognize President Lungu as a legitimate president because it believes last year's election were fraudulent. Hichilema is facing treason charges after his convoy refused to give way to President Lungu's motorcade earlier this year. Hichilema said in a statement from prison that no one person was bigger than the country Zambia, and that all Zambians should put aside their differences and work for the common good. UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says everything is open for discussion, including the controversial 2016 election and the arrests and imprisonment of Mr. Hichilema and other political prisoners.
The party and our president has always believed that conflict can best be resolved through dialogue, through negotiations at the table. But what we've seen is that the ruling party has opted to arrest people as a way of resolving the conflict. And we believe that is not the correct way to go about things.
Let me ask first, Mr. Kakoma, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, how did he come to make this decision? Was there any intermediary?
Well, there's no intermediary. Of course, people are visiting him while in prison, and he's expressing his wishes through those people, and he's communicating to people that way.
The question is, how does he want to dialogue with a government or a president that he says is illegitimate, whose government he does not recognize?
Those are exactly the issues that need to be resolved, because right now, President Lungu is also saying that he does not want to dialogue. In the past, he has said that he can dialogue with all other opposition political parties except the UPND, the party for Hakainde Hichilema. Now, if you don't want to dialogue with the largest opposition party, that dialogue with other smaller parties will be meaningless. That's why we're saying there must be no conditions. When you want to dialogue, there must be political will to dialogue and without conditions.
Is the dialogue going to mention the elections of last year?
Everything must be discussed, including the elections for last year. Even to do with the arrest of Hakainde Hichilema and other political prisoners, it has to be discussed. We think that is the only way you can diffuse the tension, because the legal route, although it can work, only can bring losers and winners. But we don't want losers and winners. We want everybody to win when we dialogue.
Mr. Hichilema is in court right now, and the spokesman for the president has said that President Lungu does not want to interfere with the court process. So when you said there's a dialogue with Mr. Hichilema, will he be free before the dialogue, or will he still be in jail?
I think we can learn from what happened in South Africa when Nelson Mandela was jailed. Even when Nelson Mandela was jailed, negotiations and dialogue continued to be done. And he was freed. He was involved in those negotiations, and the other people were involved, and Nelson Mandela was freed. Obviously, even if President Lungu says that he doesn't want to interfere with the court process, but this case is about him. The treason case is about him. So it is difficult to wash off his hands in this matter.
If it is accepted by the government, when does this dialogue get underway?
Well, we are not very sure. In fact, the church leaders have also called for dialogue with the president and asked the president to meet them. But we are now getting indications that the government has agreed, and the vice president organized a possible meeting with the church leaders, which is a part of the dialogue process.
Mr. Kakoma, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you always.
Thank you very much.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka, today's Wednesday, July 12th. And you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Zambian President Edgar Lungu is expected to meet sometime this week with leaders of the Roman Catholic Church in the country to discuss the ongoing political crisis in the country. Back in April this year, leaders of three major churches in Zambia called on the president to hold talks with the opposition. But Mr. Lungu said he would not hold talks with anyone who has refused to recognize his election. Presidential spokesman Amos Chanda says Mr. Lungu has always been open to dialogue on national issues, provided the opposition is serious.
What we make of that is that His Excellency the President has always called for national dialogue on matters that are of mutual benefit to the entire country. The opposition has been very difficult and very dismissive. But if they've come to that conclusion, they've come to that offer, it's a matter that government will immediately examine and see the content and see how they can move forward. The president assured the apostolic nuncio that he was open to dialogue, and I can announce here that the president will be meeting the leadership of the Catholic Church. All the Catholic bishops will be meeting them later this week. So the government is very much geared for dialogue on national issues.
Amos, this offer to dialogue, did it come from Mr. Hichilema himself, or, as you mentioned, the president will be meeting with all the leaders of the Catholic Church? Was this the initiative of the Catholic Church?
No, that's the initiative of the president. He called the apostolic nuncio, and the apostolic nuncio, the head of the Catholic Church. Of course, I can say that the Catholic bishops have also proposed this in the past, so it's something that is falling on fertile ground. The president, yes, I'm tired of this. We can continue. The Catholic bishops have heightened their calls and pressure that political players needed to talk to each and one another.
So if any talks are to take place, as you know, Mr. Hichilema is in jail and is on trial for treason. Does he stay in jail to dialogue, or is he likely to be released?
He has made an offer from prison himself, and he has said that in conditional dialogue. The judicial process is ongoing. I do not know how the political players on either side would react to the danger that it poses to the independence of the judiciary. But suffice to say that the president has stated very clearly that he wants the judicial process to take its course. I know that very soon he will be appearing. His trial dates have been set, so it is not known whether that dialogue will take place when he's on trial or whether he has been released, because, as you know, the judicial process in Zambia is that from the time when you're arrested, a release is possible anytime, depending on the dynamics of the case.
Amos, thank you very much. Always, it's so nice to talk with you.
All right, thanks, Sam.
Amos Chanda is spokesman for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with me from the southern city of Livingstone. Uganda's main opposition leader and former presidential candidate Kizza Besigye says President Yoweri Museveni's government must be dissolved and a transitional government formed if the country is to have lasting peace. Dr. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change says it is only the transitional government, comprised of both members of the current government and the opposition, that can organize a free and fair election. From Kampala, Mugumi Davis Rakarinch files this report.
Amidst media debates for the removal of age limits from the Ugandan constitution, former Forum for Democratic Change president Dr. Besigye told journalists this Monday that Ugandans have suffered enough as a result of violent transfer of power from one leader to another.
The reason the country is anxious about these matters must be clear to all that it touches on succession of our leadership as a country. And you all know that since independence, no leader has ever handed over power peacefully to another leader. Every leader has had to be bombed out of office. And whoever comes into office has had to bomb their way into office. And this has created a lot of trauma for the country. Many people have died, many have been maimed, a lot of property destroyed in changes of leadership.
Uganda's Speaker of Parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, refused those claims. The Parliament plans to debate on the bill requiring constitutional amendments.
Already, members are being targeted.
Yeah.
They receive threatening messages.
Yeah.
And I want to assure the country that I have not seen any bill. I've not seen the bill. It is not here. So I don't know where the debate is coming from.
Dr. Besigye claims the parliament intends to remove term limits that would effectively allow the incumbent president, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, to contest for another term of office. President Museveni has been in power since 1986 after toppling the then government through a coup d'etat. Article 102 of the Ugandan constitution prevents a person over 75 years to contest for presidency. President Museveni will be 76 years in 2021 when the next presidential elections take place.
The next constitution must be made through a transitional process. And there are many things that require a new consensus in our country. They have to be undertaken through a transitional process after the NRM and Museveni junta has relinquished that power. The task at hand, therefore, for all Ugandans is to work for the transition through which we can have a new consensus for our country. And working for that transition will require a number of things to be done by all of us.
NRM stands for the Ruling National Resistance Movement Party. The ruling party has majority members of parliament, but Besigye says the opposition will use all means possible to bring to an end the current government.
The whole question of non-violent struggle vis-a-vis use of violence is a matter that we have discussed extensively. What we advocate is not peaceful struggle. There is no such a thing. We advocate non-violence on our part, but there won't be peace because we are being attacked. People will be injured, people will be killed because the people we are challenging are armed.
Several demonstrations and rallies organized by the opposition have turned violent when members of security tried to dismantle them. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
The World Bank has injected a $56 million grant to stabilize Gambia's fragile economy at a ceremony held in the capital, Banjul. Cindy Mariner reports.
This development policy financing focus on fiscal stabilization, public expenditure efficiency, and reforms of the state-owned enterprise sector and will help establish an enabling environment for sustainable economic growth and improve service delivery over time. According to officials, the policies are supported by proposed operation and are expected to have a significant impact on restoring macro stability while supporting poverty and social indicators in the short and long run. Louise Carr is the country director for World Bank Banjul office.
What we're giving here today is actually more, and let me explain why. This is the 40 million part, which is actually 56 million. So we were able to provide additional resources given the strength of the reform effort here in the Gambia and the need for the resources for macro stability. So now we're embarking, in fact, we're starting right after we sign, we're starting on the next operation, which will be an additional, another operation for, we expect at this moment, for it to be 20 million. Now, let me tell you, as you've seen in this case, the size of the operation actually went up from our initial plans. It's not final until we sign, like today, but what we're planning is an additional 20 million to, in our first series of a programmatic DPF, which will follow a deeper program of reform.
Signing on behalf of the Gambia government, the Minister of Finance and Economic Affairs, Amadou Sane, said the loan will inject new lifeblood in the Gambian economy.
This is a budget support, and as a government, we are concerned with all the development challenges in all the sectors in the country. So I'm not going to tell you we are just going to put this money in health, education, youth activity. They are all important sectors. But I can tell you His Excellency has come up with priority sectors. The cabinet, the retreat, we have also with a compact which prioritized certain sectors. And because the resources are limited, that prioritization is important.
Reporting for VOA News in Banjul, I am Semi M.K. Marina.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced a big increase in funding to contraceptive programs. The pledge was made as delegates from across the globe gathered Tuesday for the Family Planning Summit in London. But as Henry Richwell reports, proposed cuts to family planning programs by the United States government overshadowed the conference.
Several donor countries pledged to increase family planning funding at the summit, with the largest boost coming from the US-based Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to improve women's access to contraceptives. Melinda Gates made the announcement.
The $375 million that the foundation announced today, that is absolutely not a reaction to President Trump. There is nothing anyone can do to fill the bucket of the money that the US has committed to family planning.
The United States is by far the biggest donor to global family planning programs, giving $600 million this year. But President Donald Trump announced in April he plans to withdraw financial support for the UN Population Fund, accusing it of what he called coercive family planning practices, including providing abortions. The United Nations strongly rejects the claims. Nigeria's Minister of Health, Professor Isaac Adewole, told VOA the cuts will have an impact.
Every country in the developing world will be worried because it really signifies an increase in the gap. We know family planning is one of the strongest anti-poverty strategies the world has ever known. It's a low-hanging fruit for reducing maternal mortality. It will contribute to shared prosperity.
By 2050, Nigeria is on course to be the third most populous country, with more than 400 million people. Nigeria's Minister of Budget and National Planning, Zainab S. Ahmed, said action is needed fast.
Our economy cannot grow fast enough to be able to sustain that size of population. So it's a very significant challenge and we need to address it now.
Nigeria is budgeting $3 million for family planning programs in 2017 and says more is needed. Ministers say reaching young people is key.
My friend and I, we just wanted to find out about family planning.
Safe sex, actually.
Ah, it is good that you have come. Hey, but who wants to be having the sex?
The African MTV drama Sugar, we...
That's correspondent Henry Richwell reporting from London. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very nice day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the 29th African Union Summit that was dominated by discussions on war and conflict, but also talks on investing in the African youth. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.